This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Ha, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. We do not have Dr. Jen Hawk joining us today, but we will in a future show. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Yeah, it's a little flat without Jen here, but we'll survive.
We miss her.
All right. Good to see you.
She's just taking a break this week. All right, so we've got some deep questions today. So Dr. Lyle, we're just going to get right to them.
Good.
So, dear Dr. Lyle, is it true that there are parts of the mind that we don't have access to, like a, quote, subconscious? Put another way, is there any information in our mind that we cannot reach down and consider with our conscious thinking? Some neuroscientists talk about thoughts as if they are served up to our awareness, but it seems like we can direct our thoughts. But can we access all of the information and ideas that are in the darker corners of our brain's file cabinets?
I'm not sure what they mean by darker corners. If that goes two directions, there's the concept that there's, you know, naughty or bad or traumatic things that are hidden away that you can't get access to. That's a Freudian notion, which is incorrect. If we by darker, we mean that you can't see it. You know, there's no light on it. There's no way to get light on it. That is true. Okay. And it isn't that the system isn't designed by nature to avoid information that's, quote, uncomfortable. That would make no sense biologically, although it's the core of Freudian and neo-Freudian and modern trauma thinking. So that isn't how that works. The way it does work, though, is that you have limited access to the mind's machinery. So let's think about I know you're a computer guy, Nathan, and probably a lot of our listeners are, but so when you deal with computer languages, for example, there's what we're going to call a high-level language, and then you get down to what I believe is known as machine language. Isn't that correct?
I think so. I wasn't doing a lot of computer programming.
What kind of electrical engineer are you? Anyway, all right. So the ultimately, you're down at the level of ones and zeros. That's how a computer is actually functioning. So patterns of ones or zeros can be, you know, decreed that means, you know, I don't know, picnic table. But the bottom line is that down at there's some basic computational level that's fundamentally ones and zeros. And this is going to be the nature of information itself. So the nature of information itself is one and zero. So a neuron is either firing or not firing. So the brain, just like the computer, is a digital computer. It's you know, you are either firing or not firing, and the thing counts it up, and, you know, a neurotransmitter hits a sensor or it doesn't hit a sensor. And this is the nature of information processing. Now, so the point is that there is a tremendous amount of computational dynamics that are taking place for you to ever have a word pop into your head. Okay, so, or to have a feeling pop into your awareness. So you are not aware of all of the things that are going on to cause that to happen. It's essentially, you're kind of like the CEO who reads the quarterly report. You have no idea what is taking place down at the level of, you know, the Togo's place in San Fernando Valley and how many chicken sandwiches they sold. You don't know what that is. you just know that the orders for chicken, you know, went up by 1.2% this quarter, because you're looking at the sheet and it's like, oh, that's kind of interesting. I wonder why that took place. So that's what your, that's what the mind is. The mind is a is aware of quite a bit of things that are going on inside of it, but is very much unaware of the vast majority of what is happening inside. And so the it's going to turn out that as you learn about how the mind is constructed, you can sometimes see it in operation, and you can see, you can become an expert observer once you know what to look for. This is very much akin to, for example, an expert observer of a golf swing or a basketball shot or swimming stroke. You know, if I was to analyze swimming strokes, you could show me five really good swimmers, and I would say, I don't know, they all look great to me. But a national level expert in swimming strokes, or quite frankly, even a high school swimming coach, would know so much more than I would know. And they could say that person has a significant flaw in their stroke and it's costing them. They would be able to do that because they're an expert observer. In that same way, human beings can become experts observers of the action in their own mind. Okay, but it helps dramatically to know what's there, to actually understand the mind's architecture. This is kind of a interesting historical story that that in the last 100 years or so, a la from the late 1800s, you actually had two branches, then turns into three branches, major branches of thought in human self-exploration. They all go different directions. So the greatest insight in the history of human self-analysis was Darwin. So Darwin is the original evolutionary psychologist. He was actually incredibly sophisticated and insightful. He was so far ahead of his time that he was quickly ignored and relegated to history for more than 100 years. He wouldn't be resurrected until people like Dawkins and Hamilton and Tubby and Cosmides and Buss and Pinker come along. So it would be a long time before the fact that Darwin had actually blazed a trail. He blazed a trail, and then they went down and they stopped and then they turned around. And the world turned around and then headed towards Freud. And then it also headed towards half of the academic world got so frustrated with Freudian claims that they could introspect and know the depths of the mind, that there was essentially a rebellion against that way of trying to do things, and basically saying, you know what, you can't even look at the mind. You can't even tell what's going on inside the mind. It's a black box and you can't see inside of it. And so what we're going to have to do is ignore what it seems is going on inside the mind. And we're going to instead, what we're going to do is just look at actual behavior that we can objectively agree that we just saw. Okay, that's behaviorism. And so so now you can see that there's going to be different directions that the world has gone, all of them kind of interesting historically about why they went the way they went. And it turns out that today in the clinical arena, pretty much Freudian thinking is very dominant, as well as learning theory thinking. So those two things dominate the zeitgeist of the average clinical psychologist out there trying to talk to people. They're both just horrendously and almost completely mistaken. In other words, the entire edifice is built on quicksand, and it's not right. The correct view is Darwin, which was lost. Okay. Yeah, it got resurrected. So the evolutionary psychologists do actually understand the mind's architecture. Freud had no idea. If you actually look at Freud's old sketches about how he thought the mind worked, it's laughable. You got a guy like drawing on a skeleton, little like X's on the thing, showing that, okay, well, you know, if the electricity gets blocked here, then it leaks over there, and then the person becomes an obsessive compulsive disorder. It's like he basically thought he could sketch out the human nervous system with a schematic that's about as complicated as your kid's Tinker Toy project. Okay, so he had no understanding how the mind worked, and yet this becomes the way that people look at trauma and the inability to see inside and find out where the trauma took place, and then what, how all hell broke loose in the mind after that, and why the person, you know, has all these difficulties that they do now as a result of essentially the, you know, the damage that was done as a result of some traumatic event. This is total Freudian. And the fact that they talk in slightly different language, they're all coming to basically the same conclusions. They're ignorant of the fact that they're just swallowing up a completely dead theory that was generated in the 19th century. Okay, so anyway, as we go on from there, we recover the truth, and the truth was in Darwin. Okay, with the theory of evolution being the seminal achievement of human self-understanding, as Richard Dawkins has stated, if we ever meet another intelligent species, and they ask us, you know, what will be the watershed understanding of your species? What will be the seminal achievement of your intellectual capabilities? It will be the moment when you discover why it is that you exist. Okay, it would be the discovery of the theory of evolution. And so there's been many fine achievements, many startling and brilliant achievements in human history, but that is the apex. Okay, so the that is the moment when, after 3,500 million years of life on the planet, not a single entity knew why it was even here until the answer dawned on one of them. And that happened in, you know, the mid, I think, early 1830s. So anyway, so the point is that can you now, with a correct understanding of the architecture of the nervous system, can you get better at shedding light on the unconscious processes that are actually driving your behavior? And the answer is yes, you can. And so this is the great value of the work that has been now done since, you know, beginning in the 1980s with Lita Cosmides' dissertation and Don Simon's extraordinary book on the theory of human sexuality in 1979 that inspired young David Buss to do his extraordinary career in research in human mating behavior. It goes all over the place. And it finally, today, now culminates in 2018, Robert Plumman writing Blueprint, explaining one of the greatest achievements in human history and in the history of science. And that achievement is we now understand why there are individual differences in people. It's a little hard to capture and to explain how, what an amazing moment in history we sit on. And that is that the greatest questions of human, you know, self-analysis and self-questioning, of which this question is a scratch to the surface of it. Why am I the way I am, and why do I do what I do? Why do I think what I think? Why do I feel what I feel? And what motivates me to do what it is that I do? And what motivates other people to do what they do? These are the great questions of human life. And extraordinarily, they've been answered. Okay? The answers are becoming increasingly clear and precise, but there has been a literal revolution in human self-understanding now since about 1992 with the publication of The Adapted Mind. So we're not even 30 years post-publication of that thing, and we get Blueprint 26 years later, basically saying, okay, the problem of personality has now been solved. Now, you can imagine how bizarre it is for me as a psychologist to have lived through this and to seen it and to recognize the magnitude and the importance and the implications of these extraordinary discoveries, and realize that almost my entire field not only is unaware of these discoveries, but when they hear about them, they actively run away from them. That they don't want to hear it, and then they make blackguards as fast as they can out of anybody that explicates it. This is an incredible state of affairs. Okay, so now you might look at this and you're like, God, this is incredible. It's like somebody figures out how to cure cancer and nobody wants to know what it is. And so So anyway, which brings us to Dr. Jen Hawk, which is that I'm sitting here pushing 60, you know, and I'm thinking, why? Like, you know, I don't really care that much. I know it's about status and I know some other things, but it's also about ignorance and lack of intellectual courage. But I'm just disgusted with this quietly while I go about my business and continue to try to put together in interesting and useful ways the tinker toys that have been strewn around the room by the Busses and the Pinkers and the Millers and the Tubby and Cosmides and Dawkins and Hamilton. That as I try to put these things together in ways that are useful for people, you know, just like a fumbling engineer that has come across a textbook in Newtonian mechanics, that I'm sort of like getting it together, and I'm sure some other people are too, but can't understand why everybody else says, I don't want any part of those tinker toys. I think they're evil or bad or Nazi-ish or I don't know what they think. And I'm like, why isn't the entire field beating a path to the door of these people? Why aren't they on their knees to lead a Cosmides? Okay. And Jen Hawk comes along and says, well, I could tell you why. So people are going to be hearing more. The world's going to be hearing more from Jen's brilliant analysis of this problem. But she does know why. And so that's why I'm just thrilled to have her with us in this journey from here, because I feel relieved to understand. So now that I understand what's going on better in the minds of other people who are avoiding this information, and I also understand, I have more peace with the whole thing. But so to answer the questioner, you know, do we have access, and how does it work, and can we direct our minds? This is an entertaining question for a guy like Sam Harris. What do you mean you can direct your mind? Who is you? Your mind will direct itself towards what it believes to be the most useful cost-benefit ratio of where to spend its time and energy in any kind of analytic pursuit. So I'm not sure that, quote, you direct anything. Your mind is a, you know, other people would spin their head around that and try to make sense of what we're going to say or what anyone would say about that. But I would send them to Sam Harris's book on free will. And that's a nice little tumble through the labyrinth of the question of free will. I will say that your mind directs its attention and directs its time and energy towards what it believes to be the highest cost benefit efficiency. That's what it does. It seeks the truth to the extent that the truth would appear to be a profitable endeavor to seek. When it turns out that the truth does not appear to be a profitable endeavor to seek, it tucks its head in the sand, okay, and gathers around the other lemmings and makes sure that it does what's in its personal best interest, which is to not question and not seek the truth honestly, and instead be morally outraged at the people that seek truths that are uncomfortable. And so that is the state of affairs of psychology, specifically self-science, social science in general, and a great deal of the sociological processes that are going on in the world more broadly. And so anyway, that's what I have to say about human self-insight and its limitations as well as its capacities for the future. We do have the capacity to get better at this, just like any observer of any complex situation or any complex action. The more you know, the better you are, and the better you are, the more valuable your insights can become. So this is the quiet tragedy of the modern world in social science, is that there's been a revolution that if there was 100,000 people like me with PhDs in clinical psychology out there working at this instead of a few, okay, there would be an awful lot more insightfulness and intelligent experimentation about how to help people through the kinds of decision-making problems that they face, and more innovation. Okay, so Believe me, there's a tremendous amount of innovation that can be done. And just working with Jen, Jen has come up with all kinds of creative clinical solutions to problems that I wouldn't have thought of, just because she's got a different personality, different background, and quite frankly, she's smarter. So the point is what a way we could move forward in this area in order to help people in clinical challenges is if we had a lot more people that understood this. So that's what a bunch of us are up to, is to try to get a lot more people excited and interested.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating. Dr. Lau, I know there's a lot of people, myself included, that are looking forward to this new book that you guys are writing to come out. But we will try not to put anybody in ego traps. And so we don't know if it's ever going to come out, but you know, hopefully it does.
Maybe we'll see. Maybe we can't.
Maybe about at least 2030.
Yeah.
But who knows, you know,
we might be able to beat that by a little bit.
Yeah. Now it's so interesting because I remember one of the videos I watched of you explaining the, to whole food plant-based people in the plant-based world about when they're talking to their friends and family about, you know, health and wellness and whatnot, and trying to tell them, oh yeah, this is the best way to reverse diabetes, high blood pressure, all these other things. And I think you made the point saying that your competition as far as information is the drug companies and everybody else saying, hey, you don't have to eat, you don't have to change any part of your life. You just take this pill. You just do this. You do this, do this. And it's way easier. And then here's somebody here you are telling them, oh yeah, I've got the solution, but it's going to, you know, uproot your entire life. It's going to make you a social pariah in many ways. It's going to get you to get all these things that are way more difficult. Sure. It's like, no wonder they don't want to listen.
Of course. Yeah. And that was a similar parallel, as we'll see, the Jen's insight in understanding the modern deference to trauma winds up being an extremely similar and parallel story, which she will unfold for us.
Fantastic. Well, we're looking forward to it. All right. Our next question. This is going way back to episode 2, Dr. Lau.
Oh, wow.
So, dear Dr. Lau, you mentioned in episode 2 that people can also get depressed about their personal survival, like in the case of discovering that they have cancer. But you didn't elaborate on what purpose that might serve evolutionarily. People in the Stone Age wouldn't have known they had terminal cancer, but they might have a good sense that a disease or a wound was almost certainly going to fester and kill them. What are the genes telling this person to do, and why? Is this tendency to get depressed in the face of near certain death a sign of the genes wanting the person to give up on life for the sake of not drawing valuable resources from their village anymore? As a follow-up, once a person can accept their impending death with certainty, should the depressive feelings decrease or end? Do people who embrace their mortality and relief find relief and the ability to enjoy their remaining time relatively stress-free?
Interesting question here, except that We have to get a little bit of clarity, and that is that as they say, no one in the Stone Age would ever get a lab report that would tell them that they've got terminal cancer. So if you get a lab report that says that you've got terminal cancer now, you're depressed because you've experienced a loss. And the loss is that you thought you were going to live 30 more years, and it turns out you're going to live 3. Okay, so your depression is a reaction to loss. That's what depression is. It's a signaling system to tell you when you have lost. You've lost a competitive process in romance. You've lost a competitive process in friendship. You've lost a competitive process in trade, or you have lost or somebody close to you has lost. By implication, there's been a loss to you, or in the case of your own life, you've lost function or you've lost life itself. So good feelings come with gains, bad feelings come with losses. So we don't have to look for some convoluted evolutionary engineering for the loss of life itself and its acceptance or anything else under the sun. It's real simple. Bad news is bad news because it's new information that says the circumstances are worse than we thought or that we had hoped. And that's why it is that you would have negative feelings. So depression can come from all kinds of different angles. It is not a disease. It's not an imbalance of the brain. It's a signaling system. It's the activation of a single signaling system, no different in principle than the signaling system that tells you that you're too hot, too cold, hungry, tired, thirsty, or that you've got too much salt in your mouth. It's just a feeling that is telling you that depression is a feeling that, the expectations were higher than what reality turned out to be. So that's what a loss is. You'll feel depressed if you spend a bunch of money on a fancy vacation and you took your sweetheart there and you thought it was going to be really cool and you saw the photography and then you walk out there and there's trash on the beach and some homeless people and it's not private and nice and it's not even quiet and there's a noisy rock band, you know, next door. It's like, whoa. Okay. You got a whole bunch of feelings, depression, embarrassment, frustration, anger, all kinds of negative feelings about what? A loss. And what was that loss? A discrepancy between you, what you thought was going to happen and what did happen. So that's the way to sort of understand feelings, because feelings are essentially a feedback system is what it is that they are. So good, bad, or indifferent, that's the explanation for why it is that we feel what we feel.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, when I was reading this question, the image that flashed into my head was an action movie where the hero of the movie is, you know, mortally wounded and his friends are like, no, we're not going to leave you. And he says, no, go, leave me. Mm-hmm. So he's displaying his conscientiousness,
right,
as he's dying.
Right.
You know, and so this... So I guess, so if people do get cancer, mm-hmm. and they, I guess, will they get depressed if once they kind of accept this?
They're going to get depressed, I'm sure, when they get the news. But then now the question is, quote, when they reach acceptance, does the depression lift? Well, just like anything, after you've absorbed and integrated the loss into your life's big master spreadsheet, so that, you know, if you have a business loss and it turns out that, you know, you're going to have to cut the cable bill and you can't get the new car. So you go through a depressive process while you have to reorganize your cost benefit across all of your life options. And a bunch of work has to be done to reshuffle priorities. Okay. So that's going to happen if you thought you were going to live 30 years and now you're going to live 3. It's like, oh. Okay, so you're going to get depressed. But after you go through that process, the depression is just there to signal to you that you've experienced a loss. And it's there to then analyze why the loss happened and to see what needs to be done to mitigate it. That's the whole orientation towards that process. Once that takes place, very often the depression is not nearly so severe. It will come back and forth in waves. But it doesn't need to dominate the person's existence for the rest of their life, because they could be feeling like, okay, well, that's that. So, you know, if I was ever going to go, you know, go to visit Hawaii, now's the time. Okay. Because I may not be here a year from now. And so it starts changing priorities and starts, you know, moving things around in potentially very meaningful ways. And therefore there is, there's once again profits to seek in the life experience. And to the extent that those are achieved, the person experiences moods of happiness. So there's nothing about death and its inevitability that's depressing. If that were true, we'd all be depressed because, like, sooner or later it's coming to an end. Okay. So no, it's about the experience of losses that activates those feelings. And then once those losses have been essentially engineered through the system and the matrix of cost benefit, essentially the values matrix, the universal values matrix that sits inside of you has been sort of reoriented to the new data, then you're okay. You know, and it's back to making the most of it, which is what it always is.
Fabulous. All right. Our next question. Why do human brains take so long to mature to competence? Yes, we are born relatively early to accommodate the size of the head, but it's not a matter of a few more months. No other animal is so helpful, so helpless for so many years. Are human brains slow to mature because they are so adaptable, so they hold off on forming synapses right away? Or is it because they simply have so many neurons to wire up in more complex ways compared to other animals? It truly takes that long? If the former, what is it about human intelligence that is so much slower to wire up if it's all hard-coded by the DNA anyway? And what advantage is there in postponing the ability to walk, etc., for so long?
Several things. First of all, obviously, we're running into engineering constraints because in ideally, you would have that brain completely up and functioning at day one. So what you're running into is it's just like saying, well, gee, wouldn't it be good if you could just fly from, you know, L.A. to New York in half an hour? I mean, wouldn't that be a lot better? Then 6 hours, it'd be like, God, it'd be so much better. You know, it wouldn't be any big deal to go to New York or Europe. You know, but gee, it'd be nice to go to Italy. Just, hey, you know, like have it be an hour. It's like, well, you can't just have it be an hour because there's engineering constraints at this time. And so throughout the course of evolution, in order to deal with the engineering constraints, this thing did as best it could. It made the brain as big as it could possibly make it and still get the birth through the birth canal. It compromised women's efficiency at walking that turns out to have them wiggle in a way that men find attractive because it enhances our knowledge that they're female. But the bottom line is it's less efficient. And so also then it turned out to be a very dicey trade to make the brain in such a way that it could absorb a tremendous amount of information and integrate that information in a useful way. But it's going to pull in a great deal of information about the environment. It's essentially going to build a very complex environmental map. And so it's going to take years to load in reliable data to actually understand, you know, what it's dealing with before it starts making mating decisions. So this is what it is. It would be if you were a surveyor trying to figure out, you know, which flavor of coffee Starbucks should really be offering. You wouldn't survey 10 people. That wouldn't be enough. If you were going to build a major corporation, you would say, we need a lot of data before we understand how much of our, you know, what should be on the menu and how much of what of the workspace should be directed at what kind of coffee. So how much of it should be standard coffee, how much of it should be mocha, java, you know, bling or whatever it is. In other words, so if you're going to try to figure this out, if you're going to dedicate space, like how much of the square footage should be dedicated to little baked goods versus how much should be like chips and sandwiches and stuff like that. So if you can imagine that the right way to do things, the more data you had about what people are going to buy and what the profit margins are going to be on each of those items, it would, the better data you had, the more effectively you could dedicate your space to the situation, therefore less likely to be beaten by a competitor. So so you can see that it's not going to be just a little bit of data. A company that says, oh, we're just going to follow so-and-so's vision, okay? My Uncle Louie thinks people like, you know, chicken wings that are dipped in, I don't know, steak sauce. So we're going to build a company and we're going to raise venture capital and we're going to blow $10 million on, you know, Uncle Louie's, you know, steak wings. That's a mistake. Okay, that's a mistake. You just leapt off the cliff and invested a tremendous amount of energy into a thing that is very, very unlikely to fly. Now, it might fly, but it's not very likely. So a better thing would be to run little experiments and to gather more data about what the actual underlying demand structure is of the market. That would be a far superior way to go about doing things. That's what human development is. It's a way to as people are watching and learning all kinds of things about their environment, they are then going to be able to make far more complex decisions than a chimpanzee makes in its environment, because its environment is relatively socially simple, for example, and therefore there aren't going to be complex, convoluted, political, Machiavellian, personality variances, all kinds of freaking scheming, deception, coalition formation, betrayal, heroism. No, that doesn't exist in a chimpanzee troop. Okay, but all of those things will be part of a human life. And whether or not you make good decisions or poor decisions with respect to some of those dramatic opportunities will have a large influence on the outcome of your life. That would have been true in the Stone Age. So therefore, it takes time. It takes time to let that data flow its way into the machine. And what we're seeing is that, as the person says, well, if it's all hardwired, why isn't it just hardwired? And the answer is it's not hardwired. What's hardwired is the value system behind survival and reproductive success and the subroutines that are associated: flirting, screwing, hunting, getting warm, looking essentially worried at the sky with the lightning. There's all kinds of things that are inside of human beings naturally, and that human beings will naturally know are good, bad, and to what degree, et cetera, and will have action tendencies that are already associated with them. But so much will need to be learned. So much data will need to be put into the head before reliable calculations can start to be made. And so that cannot be put in the system, cannot be essentially loaded in early. It's basically what can be loaded in, for example, is a knowledge that one needs to get warm. But you might say, well, then why don't you just get warm? And the answer is because it's already 90 degrees outside, so we don't have to go do anything to get warm. But the neural circuit is in there to actually learn it turns out that it can get colder later in the year. So when it starts to get cold, it gets colder and colder and colder. You don't know that innately because you don't necessarily live away from the equator. But if you do live away from the equator, you can learn that. And then that becomes an important thing to be putting into your calculus and to be modifying your behavior when the leaves start to turn red. Okay? So this is why a chimpanzee doesn't face those kinds of variances and doesn't make these kind of computations. So this is why the human brain, had engineering constraints on its development, but it also had constraints on how much information could flow into the system in any given short period of time that would be a reliable sample of what actually would happen in its long term. And so that's why it is the way it is that it has engineering constraints, and it also has essentially stability of information flow. And you don't want it to get fooled by something that happens early and then biases the system late, okay? This was these are all sort of important and interesting ideas in developmental embryology of the brain. Years ago, thinking from an evolutionary perspective, I think this was in 1980s, maybe before, I don't think so. I think it was 1980s. There was Belsky and Draper. Jay Belsky, I believe, and Polly Draper, I believe these were developmental psychologists somewhere, fairly prominent, had an evolutionary hypothesis, I think became known as the Belsky-Draper hypothesis, which is the notion that if females were born into a household where there was no father around, then they picked up that cue from the environment that fathers in this environment have low investment. And therefore, it would then bias them towards short-term casual mating behavior in their sexual development later, that they would pick up these cues and then it would shunt their behavior. Very interesting hypothesis. Turns out to not be supported by the evidence, so it doesn't actually work that way. But we look back fondly on that hypothesis as a very interesting one and a useful example of how to think about possible ways that the brain would work and how it would develop, and yet we wouldn't necessarily know until we investigate. So probably things like the Bilski-Draper hypothesis may in fact take place in human nature, but they may not have large effect sizes, and they may be difficult to see, but they may be in there, and they may be part of the process of a slow brain development, slowly bringing in data, and also then essentially attempting to idealize the computations that the brain makes for long-term decision-making in its particular environment.
Wow. Absolutely fascinating, Dr. Lau. This gets me curious and reading more and more and more.
Okay.
That's great. All right, Dr. Lyle, I think that's our last question for this evening.
Very good.
We'll look forward to talking to you next week. So thank you very much, Dr. Lyle. We really appreciate it.
Fantastic, Nathan. See you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.